Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on whereabouts in the world you are watching this. And we are back, that's right, we're still grumpy, we're still gits. We are the Grumpy Gits. I am your glorious host, Adam Pearson, leading you through this cacophony of disability awareness, mild hilarity, and some potential mysteries. Who knows? And I am not alone. Oh no, I am joined by three other bastions among men. First, as always, Mr. Simon Sampson. How are you, good sir?
Very well, thank you, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. I don't feel like I'm dying anymore. I got some kind of cold, non-COVID-related, sneezy coffee thing, and it was awful. It was genuinely
terrible. We did it later on. You'll see an interview with the lovely Aaron Phipps, and Adam was sneezing all the way through.
Yeah, it's sexy. I'll give you that. It is sexy. Moving on from your besmirchment of my sneeziness, good sir. He is also still here. He has, quite possibly, the best beard on the show. Mr. Duncan Cadburn, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, my man. And yourself?
Like I say, doing good, getting all geared up. We got International Day of Disabled People coming up, so I got a few talks end on end that I'm going to be doing a bit of work with Lad Bible. Then the week after, so I got a few ducks lined up in a row, and finally, last but by no means least, he is, has always been, and will always be the greatest editor in the world. He also has a second name, Chris Lee Smith. How's it going?
It's going all right, not great. By default, Duncan is the greatest editor in the world because my iPad broke. Also, notice how I didn't flex and put Pro in there as well. Just take note. Okay, it's cold, really, really cold. I did go to Drayton Manor, and I also bought a running machine that I'm 3 stone too heavy to run on. So yeah,
wow,
yeah, It's a weird week.
But when you say the iPad broke, is it a hardware thing? Is it a software thing? Is it a child-related breakage?
No, it just won't charge. So I've got to send it back. And apparently it's going to take 8 weeks. So editing duty is going to Mr. Duncan Cadburn. So, yeah, lose my title.
Mate, you can make a quarter of a baby in the same amount of time that it takes to fix an iPad.
I'm not sure they make quarters to make the baby, but yeah.
I'm reliably informed it took me 6 seconds to make ours, so, you know.
Okay, move on. So, that local sports team. Let's crack on, gentlemen, and we will open, as always, with our ridiculous questions segment. So, Mr. Chris No iPad Lee Smith, what do you have for us today?
Okay, first question is, what is your worst food-related horror story? Let's start with Duncan this week.
Oh, I can do this one instantly. I went to a mate's house. Back when I was at high school, I went to a mate's house who were actually playing truant. And I got to his house and really hungry. I saw there's some apples on the thing, and I went and got this apple, and it looked really good. I took a bite in, and it was literally, you could see the maggots just crawling through the middle of it, and it was just absolute horror. It was just like you see in horror films, you know, when it's all kind of, I was sick on the spot just from this point of it. It was horrific.
It's like a scene from a horror, isn't it?
Actually, I've got another one if you want to hear it.
If it's better than the apple, then yes.
I'd had a bottle of port and went to see a movie with some mates, and I hadn't eaten, so I'd had this bottle of port and got to the theatre. Before we got there, we thought, let's get a KFC. And I'm like, yeah, stupid idea, you know, port and then KFC just sitting on top of it. And I got into the cinema, and I just went, "Boy, this is bad. I'm just gonna go to the loo, boys." It's a public toilet, so I thought, there's no way I'm getting down on my hands and knees for this. So I sort of stood there and tried to aim as best I can as I projectiled all everywhere. Cleaned myself up, went out, and I sat back down, and it was about, you know, that sort of 5 minutes later, and you get the second wave, that sort of sweaty chill. Oh, crap. So I've gone back in. As I've gone in, there's this guy with a mop and bucket walking out looking really pissed off. Got in the same cubicle and all been cleaned. I've done a repeat performance. And all I can think of is this poor guy getting fired because I told you to clean it. I did. Well, it's still pretty messy.
Okay, let's move on to Simon. What is your worst food-related horror story?
The worst thing that's ever happened to me relating to food is when I found out I had an allergy to shellfish. Ooh. And I found out the hard way. So this is going back 20 years. And we went to a local pub, and I had a prawn cocktail for a starter. And I thought, right, I've never had prawns before. Let's try them. Let's give them a go. I thought, oh, these are quite nice. I thought, brilliant. And a couple of hours later, back at home, and don't feel quite right. And uncontrolling diarrhea and vomiting, we had to call out the ambulance. They literally sat me in the bath and said, you've got a reaction to prawn. The best thing to do is wait till it all comes out, because there was the bath, you can imagine, was full of shit and vomit, and it was going. I looked like, after I finished, they took me to hospital because they thought I looked like I had a fight with Mike Tyson, because I burst all the veins in my face, and you know, you can make it go red and stuff, and it was like I had like cracks all over the front of my face, and it was quite dangerous, and that was one of the nastiest situations I've ever had, and I feel sorry for my partner at the time. You had to clean up the path afterwards.
I was going to say, it's a miracle you're not single.
That's amazing. Let's move on to Adam. What's your? You've got some stories to top here. What is your worst food-related horror story?
In my first year of uni, I went on a date with one of the girls of next door, Steph. And we went to Nando's. And when you go there, you order, you do your thing. And this one had, like, table set. This was a good-ass Nando's. And I ordered what I normally go for. Butterfly chicken breast, peri-peri fries, garlic bread. And she ordered, I think, the double burger. And I asked her how hot she wanted it. And she was like, oh, I'll have the hot, please. Because she'd just done a gap year out in the Far East, so I'd gotten used to spicy food. And not wanting to look like a pussy on a first date, I went, I'll have the hot as well.
Okay, how did that turn out then?
I've never cried in a restaurant or on a date before, but I managed to tick both things off my "you're fucking tragic person" bingo card. In
the
one
irony
go.
That you didn't want to look like a pussy.
Yeah.
He didn't, but then he amplified it anyway. Oh, that's amazing.
And so that happens. I'm crying on a date, but I think I've spotted it out quite well. As soon as I get home,
I'm in sweats coming down.
And tears, and maybe a little bit of snot. I don't recall, it was a while ago.
Snot bubbles coming out as you're crying in a restaurant. That's attractive, isn't it?
It's been the most disgusting topic we've ever.
I know, it's a good one.
And then at the end of the day, get home and immediately collapse. And it turns out I'd given myself a little hernia from the hot sauce.
Hernia as well. This is an amazing question. That's fantastic. Let's move on to question two. You've just bought a boat. What would you name it and why? Let's go with Adam for this one.
A lot of people who buy boats give them like really grandioso names. And this is true. Vince McMahon, who owns WWE, his boat is called Sexy Bitch.
That's weird.
I wouldn't call it that. I'd probably call it Norman.
Norman.
Yeah.
Ironically, what's the thing behind Norman? Yeah.
Well, just because then it'll be like parked up with all these other boats, like kind of Colossus, Triumph, Conqueror, Norman.
Okay, let's move on to Duncan. You've just bought a boat. What would you name it and why?
I'd go the Arrested Development route. I'd have to call it the C word.
That's a good one. Simon, same question. You've just bought a boat. What would you name it and why? Let me guess, you've already got a boat and you're about to tell us the name.
Actually, not far wrong. I had a boat before I had a car.
Did you? Do you want to rename this fictional boat, or do you want to tell us the name of the boat?
No, the name of it was Oscar.
Oscar. That's along the lines of Adam.
I was a big fan of Oscar Wilde, still am, and I named it after Oscar Wilde. And it was on Kinnikun Loch Tummel. It was on Loch Tummel in Scotland, and I used to take it out of fishing, used to go diving and stuff, and it was great. It was fantastic.
I do like that. I like the Oscar Wilde. That's got a nice ring to it. Are you sticking with the Oscar then, or do you want a new name for this fictional boat?
Oh, I mean, I could call it Boaty McBoatface, but that might have been taken.
Boaty McBoatface. Okay, let's move on to question three. What's the dumbest way you've hurt yourself? Let's start with Simon this time.
Oh, God, where to start? Jesus. I've broken every bone in my body, pretty much. I mean, before and after I was disabled. I fell on the driveway because I'm using crutches. I fell off a curb, broke my ankle. I'll tell you a good one. I got knocked out by a cricket ball. That was fun. Yeah, when I was about 12 or 13, I was in Syston cricket team, and we're in the nets. And one thing you don't do is you don't turn your back on the nets. And we're just queuing up to bowl, and someone went, Simon. 2 hours later, I woke up with a big, massive Coke can on my head, and I still got a bowl patch from where I got hit. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's go with Adam next. What's the dumbest way you've hurt yourself?
I once went on a date to Nando's. No.
This is a different date, though, this one.
Yeah.
It takes them all there.
I did get hit by a black cab on the way to the Under the Skin audition and broke my leg, but that's quite a well-told and well-trodden story. So what other... Okay, again, first year of uni, round the back of our halls was a massive hill, and then one time we found... next to this massive hill, an abandoned shopping trolley.
So
I go for it, but I decide to stand up and do it, and then chaos ensues, and I wind up twisting both my big toenails into the toe.
Oh, God.
And have to go and see, like, a shop that has, like, both my big toenails permanently removed. And it hurt to walk for quite a while. It was like one of the dumbest things I've done, and the most, the pain to stupidity ratio was awful.
I was expecting, yeah, I broke six bones. Only you could do that and come away with no toenails.
Yeah, that is quite amazing. But you do a lot of dancing in your room as well, didn't you? Hurt yourself once, or have I concocted that?
I did. Knee myself in the head, dancing in my.
Wasn't it to Bewitched or something? I try and remember what it was on Twitter or something.
It was absolutely to Bewitched Sailor B.
trying to do the Irish dance thing.
That's exactly what. That's exactly where it happened.
Yeah, but they've also admitted they can't Irish dance to save their lives.
What? And now we know, nor can I.
Okay, let's move on to Duncan. What's the dumbest way you've hurt yourself?
There's a fantastic Australian band called the Hoodoo Gurus, and I've gone and seen them live. It's the first time I've seen them live. And we were packed into this. And you can imagine, like, sardines. It was like a 200-person venue, and they crammed about 3,000 people in there. Everyone's in there, like, you know. So the whole place was just this big mosh pit, and everyone's... And you couldn't move. And this guy decided to get on the stage and jump into the crowd, do the old stage dive. And they started spinning him. Everyone was sort of spinning him around. And he's wearing these big Doc Martens, and this thing just clocked me, boom, straight in the head. Knocked me out clean. But I couldn't fall over because we were all wedged up. So I'm unconscious.
So this was like a Weekend at Bernie's sort of thing, where really you're just kind of this dead person in a crowd. But you can't fall over.
This huge footprint on my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just magic. But yeah, they got me to the side and I woke up sort of dazed. And my mate was laughing his ass off once he knew I was okay. He was just like, it was the funniest thing I've ever seen.
There we go. The Voodoo Gurus doing it before Travis Banks made it cool and expensive.
Too soon.
Don't believe in too soon. Oh, there we go. Ridiculous questions, and did you really write set back at least 3 years with those answers? This show will one day ruin my career. It'll turn up in like 5 years' time. And it'll be like, oh yeah, Adam Pearson made fun of this tragedy and shat himself at Nando's. Oh, we should never hire him again.
You shit yourself.
Nearly.
I thought that was your school parents' day.
that also happened.
I would like to point out, any story starting when I went to Nando's is always going to end up bad.
Yeah. It never ends, and now we're happily married. No, that's never how that one is. In Croydon, someone got stabbed in Nando's a few weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah. I was in the pub outside, and I was just like, what do you know? Happy Wednesday, Croydon. Happy. Oh my God, we got a Wendy's in Croydon.
This show is brought to you by Nando's.
It's one way to suck the humour out of a show, isn't it? Someone got stabbed in the Nando's. All laughing stopped. How do I react
we're laughing
to this?
Someone getting stabbed. This is not going to go down well. This is not. I mean, horrific thing to happen.
I mean, it was all right. It was all right. Non-life-threatening injuries. Direct quote.
Oh, that makes it better then, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, weirdly, yeah, a little bit.
Oh, we're going to get sued.
Duncan, you have a story, I believe, that isn't about Nando's or cutlery.
No, neither of those things. I don't know if you guys got to see the documentary Ed Balls did on BBC One last week. Anyone get a chance to see that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a really interesting insight. I got a lot of negative feedback via Twitter and stuff like that. I kind of understand why, because we do see this awfully sort of privileged side of things, I guess. But I thought, as a carer, as somebody who's had to give up my career and go into full-time care in a different way, obviously, but I thought it was really interesting seeing him. So the premise was that he actually went and worked in a care home for dementia and the elderly. And because I'm part of Devon Carers, I'm a carers ambassador for them. Like, I've been getting in touch with that side of things because of other people who are also carer ambassadors. And it really struck me that what I really got from it was that this can happen to anyone. And there was a fantastic moment where he was asking one of the staff members, if you were talking to Boris right now, if I was the Prime Minister, what would you say to me? And it was, so her response was just, treat us with some respect. And, you know, because you're going to need us one day and I'm not wiping your ass.
Alison, you know social care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the Prime Minister. I've just done a speech where I've said I'm going to reform social care.
Yeah.
What have I got to do?
You need to look after us.
Right.
Stop putting us at the bottom of the list. Because you'll need that care one day. And I ain't wiping your bum.
It was like, it's a fair point. But it really struck me that these things, that I don't know why there isn't more emphasis put on the care system, because we are all going to need it at some point. So, and I think, you know, when you relate it back to disability, you never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, disability isn't something most people are born with. It's something that happens to them. And, yeah, I wanted your thoughts on that, especially, for, obviously, Simon, with what you've been through.
Yeah, I mean, my wife now is my full-time carer.
Yeah.
And now we do get a bit of money from DWP because I'm self-employed, so she gets paid to be my carer. But I knew a carer's allowance, if you're looking after a child, is absolutely poor and ridiculous. No. But also as well is, I know it's a slightly change in the subject, but it's kind of on the subject as well, is the government introduced a pay policy for how much you're going to pay towards your care in the future. And care is expensive. I mean, I worked for Leicester City Council for years, and I watched them close the local care homes down. And at local care homes, they were fantastic. They were clean, they were tidy. You had staff who were employed full-time, who were on full-time contracts, so they didn't have to worry about where the next paycheck was coming on because they're not on zero-hour contracts. And, they, you know, you could put someone in a care home for £350 a week. Well, as soon as the care homes closed, private care homes doubled their costs, because they haven't got the local competition anymore.
Yeah.
And my granddad now is in a care home and he's paying £850 a week, which is, it's absolutely ridiculous, the cost of it. And I think you need the right staff, you need the right people looking after elderly people, absolutely. And if they're not paid correctly and they're on the zero-hour contracts, then you're not going to get the dedicated staff that you need. And I think that's vital for any care home. And the government introduced a bill where it basically takes away all the money from poor people. Because they said you can pay, I think it was, you pay up to £86,000. Nobody will pay any more than that. Well, if you've got £100,000 worth of assets of your life savings, well, that's it. It's gone. Your life savings have gone to look after your care. Where if someone is rich and they're well off, it's not going to affect them as much because they only have to pay £86,000 worth of care. So that person who is poor probably works in a row, you know, worked 40 years, hasn't worked any harder or lower than anyone else who's got a bit of money. And they're being punished for it because they don't have the right amount of income, and all their life savings that they want to pass on to their children, their grandchildren, has gone to the government, which is completely incorrect.
One of the points that was made on it is that if you're, I think it's 23,000, if you're earning more than 23,000, you're considered self-funding. You lose all rights. So that's, you know, that's a really low income. But suddenly they've got to pay for homes which cost literally, you know, thousands a month.
Mm.
And how can that be sustainable? It's not. The system is just so unfocused on what's really needed.
I think what they need to do is, it's one of these things where they need to nationalise it, because private organisations are taking advantage of people who are being funded by local authorities. And if the local authorities had the care homes and paid their staff properly and gave them full-time contracts and gave jobs to people who actually wanted to do it, then I think the care system would improve dramatically. And I've been there and done it. I've met some staff who don't care whatsoever. They just see it as a job. I've seen people who call, say, these are my 50 grandparents. I love every single one of them. And that's the difference between having proper staff and agency staff and on proper contracts and having proper care in the homes and proper meals, of course, as well.
I didn't particularly like Ed Ball's representation of carers. It barely scratched the surface. And you saw that through when I was seeing on Twitter people who were saying the same thing. And you actually mentioned it, that it was a very, very privileged view because he's well off. It isn't a full-time job for him because he's got carers that come in. And that's not a representation whatsoever. There's a lack of sleep, a lack of funding, and none of that was put out there. I like the idea that it raised awareness, but how can you raise awareness if you're not actually showing the struggles?
You're absolutely right. It's like doing an expose on McDonald's and just showing people sitting in a restaurant. It says nothing of what's going on in the background and what goes into making a burger and all that kind of stuff. They did little bits that did sort of go there. One of the things I did appreciate was he sort of came out afterwards like, I didn't realize that, you know, you can only hold the spoon to a person's mouth. You can't force them to eat. Yeah. They had some vision. So it can take an hour to feed my mother, who the reason he did this is because his mother's gone into care. And it's like these sort of specialized things, and you don't realize, he just says, took this long to eat. Real detail of what it takes to be a carer, it would be really good to see this move on to something deeper, which is actually, you know, we've got the A&E shows and we've got these, fly on the wall documentaries in hospitals and stuff, but we don't see that in care homes and so forth. It would be really, I would like to see something that actually really lifts the lid on what it's like for the carers.
I was going to say, the closest we've got is Derek, isn't it? And that's a mockumentary by Ricky Gervais. It does pull on the heartstrings.
The issue I have with a few BBC documentaries, and they keep on doing it, is while they do raise awareness and they raise attention to the subject, they're still putting a spotlight on the issue, but they're not showing the hardness of it. They're not showing the grittiness of it. You're not showing the person with dementia who's screaming at 3 o'clock all night in the morning, keeping everyone awake. You're not keeping, getting someone in the shower. They're not showering for 3 or 4 days and they're getting infections. You're not showing the bit where the people die and they turn over the beds within a few hours to get a new resident in there after they've died a few hours ago. In one case where I was, you had to wait 18 hours for a private ambulance to come and collect the bodies, and the bodies were just sitting there. The BBC aren't showing what actually happens in care homes. They're showing Ed Balls' story about what happened in the care home to him. And that's fine. That's not an issue. That's a personalization to him. And that's absolutely fine. Do a documentary about that. Raise the issue. But if you're going to do an issue about care homes, you need to show the true facts and the hardness and the reality of care homes, and not the litsy gritsy, snowball version of...
We need to get away from this, the idea that everything, it all comes back to celebrity as well.
Yeah.
And what really upsets me is this wouldn't have happened if it wasn't Ed Balls or it wasn't somebody else. You know, there's a documentary coming from the McGuinnesses about autism, because their kids and Christine has been diagnosed as autistic now as well. But again, it takes that celebrity suddenly. Why are we insisting it has to be? We're only interested if it's somehow celebrity. Let's hear some real stories of real lives. I think it's why podcasts have taken off the way they are, because people actually want to hear the reality and not just what it's like for, you know.
It's entertainment and marketing, though.
That's exactly it.
It's broadcasting, but that's unless they've got a face on there.
They don't need to be winning the race.
They don't, but they see it. I mean, it's a gamble, isn't it? They've got to fund this, and if they've got a familiar face, it's already the marketing done, because they've got this celebrity telling a story. So they're kind of limiting the gamble of whether it's going to be deemed a success or a failure. So it's TV, isn't it? It's media.
And it's all a bit like low level and a bit wanky, and it takes sort of really hard and important issues, and it attempts to make them palatable.
Yeah.
They go for palatability and entertainment over accuracy and authenticity. And when you use a very polarizing figure, such as Ed Balls as well, that also takes away from the subject. There will just be people going, oh, Ed Balls, he's a twat, and not listening to what it's actually being said or what's trying to be communicated. And I completely agree, Duncan, something where they rig up a care home like they did with Education Essex or those Channel 4 shows, where they just show how full on it is and kind of take away the mysticism, and maybe do something where you can see the real difference, the cavernous difference in quality between actual carers and agency workers. Well, a while ago, myself, Simon and Duncan interviewed Paralympic rugby star, gold medalist, and utter legend, Aaron Phipps. So in a minute, we're going to cut future us, we're going to cut to past us. Past us will thank future us, and then we'll get on with the interview. Confused? Me too. Time's a paradox. It's amazing. Here's the interview. And thank you, future us, for handing over to present us.
So let's talk about Aaron Phipps, who actually is a gold medal Olympian, who's come to join us today on the show.
Stop. What? You can't say Olympian. It's a disability. Paralympian.
Paralympian.
Dropped it.
Right, I'll do that again. So let's be serious about this. We've been joined by Aaron Phipps, a gold medal Paralympian. Outtake. And we want to know what happened, how you became a rugby star, Kilimanjaro. Aaron, go.
All right, okay, and we're on. Okay. Able-bodied up to the age of 15. Right, I'm going to try and do this. We try and do it really quickly. Able-bodied up to the age of 15. Contracted meningococcal septicemia or meningitis type C, was rushed into hospital with acute respiratory and renal failure. As a result of that, I became an amputee. I realised this is a great leveller, isn't it, a podcast? You'd never know I'm sat here with prosthetic legs. Try and get them in the camera shot. There's one. Right. I won't get them both up because I reckon I'll fall off the chair. But yeah, I'm a bilateral below knee amputee, so I'm missing both my legs below the knee and most of the tips of my fingers. And I was in hospital for a year. Not the best time to be in hospital when you're 15 years old, but probably the worst and best thing that ever happened to me in one fell swoop. Came out of hospital, wasn't interested in disability sport to start with. I met my wife, Vicky, who I love very much. I've been with her ever since. And she was one who convinced me to go and try disability sport. Went along, gave it a go, and kind of fell in love with it. Did some wheelchair racing, did the London Marathon twice. That led me into trying arguably the most bonkers wheelchair sport there is, called wheelchair rugby. Now, that all happened by chance. I met a couple of guys who played wheelchair rugby. They said, come and give it a go. I went, yeah, all right. I then went and Googled wheelchair rugby and watched it on YouTube and watched these videos of people getting smashed out of their wheelchair. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, you know, it's bananas. It's the only full contact wheelchair sport. Thought, don't really want to go and do this. It got convinced to go and try it. Went along, gave it a go, got dragged down to a session, and I got smashed out of a wheelchair. And I've never been smashed out of a wheelchair before. But I laid there on the floor, all calm and still, and I went, I want to hit you back. And it brought out a dark side of me that I didn't know I had, Simon. It turns out I absolutely love smashing people out of their wheelchair. So that's how my journey into wheelchair rugby started. And from then on, it was a bit like that moment in Toy Story. Do you know the bit with the green aliens and the grabbing machine? And they go, it's you. Do you know the bit, right?
You are the one that decided to climb into this.
The claw. It moves. I have been chosen. Farewell, my friend.
And it was a bit like that. And next thing you know, I'm going off around the world playing wheelchair rugby in America, Australia, New Zealand. Didn't have a bloody clue what I was doing, but I was really fast because of all the races that I'd done. And got back to the UK. I'm in these meetings with UK Sport, Paralympics GB, all these important people. And they said to me, do you realise if you work your backside off, you could get selected to go to the Paralympics in London? And this was in 2009. So I had this unbelievable opportunity put on my lap almost. But I was obviously going to have to work my backside off to get it. Because, you know, being a Paralympian, I don't have free holiday villas in Spain like you, Simon. You know, I had to work a full-time job as well, like normal people. And
there was plebeians that are just yeah.
You know, I'm old school disabled. You know, when you get it like properly, and then you don't get a payout.
I'm liking you more and more as we go on.
Slap on the
same.
Yeah. I'm just saying, pages me. You know, you pull up in the disabled bases, all these Range Rovers, and you're there in your mobility car. But you know, it is what it is. But you know, the good news was all the hard work paid off, and I got to go to the Paralympics in London, which was phenomenal. It was an absolutely amazing experience. We were like movie stars for a couple of weeks, and just gone off on a tangent about disability sport. I think the way that London changed perceptions of disability in the UK forever was phenomenal. You know, before the games, I used to wear jeans all the time. I didn't ever show my legs off. And then I wear shorts now because it's more comfortable. My legs get hot, etc. And it's, you know, a bit less restrictive. There was a fundamental shift in perceptions, I think. We got to go to London and I was a really fresh new player. But unfortunately, we came fifth, which as an athlete, you don't really like to talk about that. You know, you want to get the gold, silver or the bronze, don't you? You don't want to come fifth. Fifth is crap. It's still a phenomenal achievement to be a Paralympian.
But yeah, I'm just fifth in the world, you know.
I mean, I'm fifth in the world or something. It's not high. Yeah, but if you're an elite athlete, you don't, you know. So my proudest bit at London wouldn't have been collecting a medal anyway. Proudest bit was after the game against America, Vicky was in the audience with my little girl, Ella. Ella was a tiny little baby. She was 1 year old in the hustle and bustle of London, completely out of her routine in a sellout crowd. And I got as close as I could to them on the court and I was waving and they were in the audience. Ella clocked me, leant forward on her mummy's lap, put her arms up and I could see her saying, cuddle, 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 cuddle. And that was the first proudest moment of my life.
You said it was the worst and best time that happened to you. Do you want to just explain that a bit further?
Yeah, absolutely happy to talk about that. It was, I was making pretty negative choices as a teenager and I don't really know what route my life would have gone down, to be honest. So, you know, if you want to kick up the bum, nearly dying will do that for you. And it makes you very aware of your own mortality, which I'm going to go off on a tangent here. But I think people think when you've been through something like meningitis, like I have, that instantly makes you resilient. I don't think that makes you resilient. What it did, though, was made me take opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise taken, which then taught me to be resilient because, you know, throwing up on yourself at 5 o'clock in the morning when you're doing a training session. That's how you learn coping strategies to put yourself under pressure when you're under pressure to cope. So I think meningitis was horrendous, but it gave me a completely outlook on life and it made me do things that otherwise I wouldn't have done.
What I love about that, though, is it reminds me of the Rick Allen story. So Def Leppard's drummer and losing the limb in the car at, you know, very young age again. But it seems like you had that same... I don't know if it's resilience. I think you're right. But I think it's something, there's a mental capacity that takes place there that says, this isn't going to own me. I'm going to fucking own it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was never a point where Rick Allen was like, oh, I can't drum anymore. It was like, well, what can I do to carry on doing this? And I think that wake-up call of, you know, you take something and I'm going to make the damn best of this or I'm going to let it crush me. And you seem something in your character says, I'm going to crush it rather than the other way around.
Yeah, I wish I could bottle it, to be honest. And I don't know what that is. I think you're right. There was a moment in hospital when you think, right, this is it. I'm either done or I'm going to fight. And I chose to fight. And it gave me a drive that I never had before. Maybe sort of roll back my shoulders and go, I can't kill me. Nothing can. And, you know, if anything, it made me more determined. So I met a lot of people on my journey as well who go the other way and they really, really struggle. What is it? What is that point, that moment when you go, actually, I'm going to beat this, or actually, no, I'm done? There's something, isn't there? And I can't tell you what that is. But, yeah, I just wasn't beaten by it, not at all.
Yeah. I mean, that exactly what happened to me is because I got told, I don't know how much. So, for the public, me and Aaron met a few months ago at Disability Union in Southampton, and he asked me a question. He goes, when I became disabled in 2014, was it the best thing that ever happened to you? And it kind of was, but it was kind of not at the same time because I got told I'd never sit up again. Okay. And then I was going to be flat on my ass. But as soon as I sat up, I knew I could start working. I knew I could do stuff. And it took me months to get to a point where I could actually sit up for a few hours at a time and I could start writing and typing and obviously where I am today. And my injury gave me a direction to where I was going. So beforehand, I was working for Leicester City Council and in social services, and I probably would still be there today. But this has given me a whole new direction of life and more of a drive than I ever thought possible.
You laid down then? Is that what you laid down, Simon? Is that for people who are listening? Yeah. Are you just lazy or is that why you laid down?
Yeah, that's
why you laid down.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it's that old adage, isn't it? That life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you then choose to handle it.
Yes.
And I think it's easy to And I know we're all kind of hypothecating with the benefit of hindsight and disabled people who manage to kind of catch a break or, as my mother would say, get on with it. But I think it's true. I think you reach a almost Damascus Road moment where you make that choice as to whether this will own you or your own this, particularly at 15 as well. I think who you become, I think the person you become between the ages of 15 and 21 is the person you're going to be for the rest of your life, whether you're disabled or not. So you need to make sure that you become a good one. Aaron, I once heard Wheelchair Rugby described to me as, and I quote, Gladiators meets Robot Wars. How much truth is there in that?
Yeah, I've heard it called Robot Wars a few times. Well, do you know the original name was actually Murderball? And this is a true story. So it was invented in Canada in the 70s. There was some quadriplegics who wanted to play a team sport. The only team sport was wheelchair basketball. Basketball's quite heavy, net was up quite high, and if you're a quad, you've got your neck up really high. So they were struggling to get a team sport that they could partake in. So they invented this sport where you could pass is a volleyball any which way, but you could crash into each other. And they called it Murderball. They then struggled to get corporate sponsorship for a sport named Murderball. They couldn't enter it into the Paralympics called Murderball, so they changed the name to Wheelchair Rugby. That's why it's nothing like rugby, but it's got that name.
You talked about the disappointment of London. What you haven't talked about is Tokyo.
No. Well, there's no joke to the story. Yeah, I'm just building it up.
Well, Duncan, spoilers.
No, it's all right. No, we haven't talked about it.
Didn't give anything away.
No, I didn't. Yeah, okay, I'll talk about Tokyo. So I competed in London, took a break, climbed Killy. We'll talk about that in a while. And yeah, went back in 2017 playing wheelchair rugby. So I started training again. Everything was going in the right direction. I was training at Southampton Solent University in their sports science department. You know, I'm on a £150,000 treadmill. I've got professors of sports science training me. Everything's going in the right direction. And then COVID happened. The games were postponed a year. So we did fly out a year late and no spectators because of COVID, unfortunately. So I couldn't take my girls and I was gutted. But they were watching at home and there was going to be these parties in my house that were going to get grander and grander as the week went on, I think. So we flew out the 17th of August, first game 25th of August against Canada, beat Canada. Second game was against New Zealand, beat New Zealand. Next game, last group game was against America. America beat us, which meant we had the tougher semi-final against Japan. Now, this was going to be tougher. Japan were the current world champions. It was a home games and we hadn't beaten them in 8 years. So I remember managing expectations at home. I was ringing up Vicky and saying, look, there's a chance we're not going to win this. This is going to be a really tough game. And we went into the game and it just started to go our way. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I was marking this player called Ikazaki Daisuke. I've blocked him and he's called a timeout. This doesn't happen. And I remember just thinking, we could do this. Felt like I had fireworks going off at the back of my head, screaming, if you win this, you'll guarantee the silver medal. I'm starting to suppress all those feelings. But we beat Japan. And not only did we beat them, we smashed them. We were up by 10 points at one point. It went back down to 7 points because we started showing off in the last quarter. There was a bit where there was a minute left. And my teammate, Jim, looked up at the clock, and he obviously had been concentrating. He hadn't looked at the time for a while, and they weren't ever going to pull back a 7-point lead in a minute. And he looked at the clock, and he made this noise like a kid at Christmas. He went, "I went, Jim, don't worry about that. Focus on what you're doing. We've got to finish the game. So we finished that. Now we're into like fairy tale stuff. You know, no European team has ever won a medal in the wheelchair rugby. We're fifth in the world, you know, and we're now in the final of the Paralympics. If we lose the final, silver medal, win the final, gold medal. And we played America in the final. It was on the 30th of August on Channel 4. Over 1 million people tuned in to watch that final at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was one of those games where we went up by a point, they went up by a point, we went up by a point, they went up by a point. But we pulled away in the last quarter and we did it. We actually did it. We went all the way and got the gold medal, which was absolutely phenomenal. I still don't know what to say about it. We've never won anything before.
You said, in a remarkably casual way, oh yeah, climb Kili. And yeah, Kilimanjaro. I look at a photo of Kilimanjaro and I get tired. So how was it climbing Kilimanjaro?
So in 2016, it started as a charity challenge. I've raised lots of money for the Meningitis Foundation over the years. And when Mike from the charity turned up at my house and sort of said, we send thousands of university students up Kilimanjaro, do you fancy it? I went, all right, yeah. Agreed to it. He then left. I then had to Google Kilimanjaro because I didn't actually know what it was. I mean, I had a bit of an idea, but I wasn't completely sure. So, and if you Google it, first picture you see, it's like higher than the clouds. It's like, oh, brilliant, I've agreed to climb this. So I need to explain. So I've got prosthetic legs, but I've got bad scars on my legs. So if I wear them too much, they get sore. So I have to do things in the wheelchair. So we set this goal to become the first person in the world to get to the top of Kili in a chair, but without any assistance. Which seemed like a good idea when we set that goal. I got myself a...
No, it didn't. Under no circumstances does that sound like a good idea.
Well,
when you said the pictures of it, you just said it's higher than the clouds. What makes you think going up in... I have trouble going to Tesco in a wheelchair. No, going up fucking Kilimanjaro.
And I bet I know why you have trouble getting there. All the disabled bays are always full, aren't they? I never see anyone else in a wheelchair. Where do these people come from? You make a fair point. I wasn't up for getting carried, and that's how it started, really. I'm a bit weird. It's in my head. I don't know why. I had these ideas, and the plan was to get up to the top without any assistance, which seemed like a good idea. Got myself a specially adapted wheelchair called a mountain trike. Went out in the New Forest near where I live, found the biggest hill I could, went up and down it about 3,000 times.
Yeah, because that's the same fucking thing.
Yeah. Oh, God, I've lost this much ranges. You guys are...
Yeah, let's go down a track supported by the National Trust. Yeah,
that's the same. I'm just wondering what the parking facilities were like on Kilimanjaro.
Yeah, no, they didn't have any. There's no disabled base there. No, yeah,
like, the thing, the fucking ultimate is you get to the top and there's a disabled bay. You're like, fucking hell.
You wallies, right. I've got to stop laughing. Face it. Smiling, wait.
Did you get to the first camp and there was a bloke there waiting to give you a ticket for the blue badge? You didn't have it on you.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, what are you doing here? Raised £20,000 charity and we flew out to Tanzania. Oh, if any of you get the opportunity to go to Africa, you've got to go. Amazing place. We set off on day one in the chair at midday. It was meant to take between 2 and 3 hours to get to the first camp. Didn't take between 2 and 3 hours, 6.5 hours. So we camped overnight, set off on day two. But I should explain, it takes most able-bodied people about 6 days to get to the top. You zigzag your way up and you camp on the way up. Day two was meant to take between 4 and 5 hours. Didn't, took 10.5 hours. Next day, didn't really come as any surprise. Joshua, the head guy, came over to speak to me in the morning and sort of said, what's your goal? I said, well, it's to get to the top. He said, good, but you're not going to make it in the chair. It's moving too slowly. We're going to have to carry you. So I swore a lot, said, that's not happening. Even by my standards, I can't tell you what I said. I went on a mad one. Said, under no circumstances are you carrying me. I had some knee pads with me. I didn't even take my legs. They would have just got in the way. I've got bad scars. I couldn't have walked. I took my knee pads with me. I had a really technical piece of mountaineering equipment called duct tape. So I duct taped my knee pads to my legs, and I crawled on my hands and knees for 4 days to get to the summit.
That's my astonishing. God.
Why?
Tell you what, you lot have a lot of banter. This is what really happened. This is what I don't normally tell people. I went, if I get carried up this mountain, I'm never going to hear the end of it. There was a little voice at the back of my head saying, people are going to take the piss out of you forever. So I went, I'm not getting carried. So I just duct taped the knee pads to my legs and went for it. I mean, it wasn't that simple. The first day, 9.5 kilometers up the mountain, got into camp that night. Went into the tent with Holly, the doctor who was with us looking after me. Like, we took off the knee pads. I'm there crying. She's there crying. You know, my skin was breaking down, but it wasn't horrendous. And I'm sort of confiding her, saying, look, if I'm not going to do myself any serious damage, like if I'm never going to be able to wear my prosthetic legs ever again, we're going to quit. If it looks like I'm getting an infection, I'm going to kill myself, then we're going to quit. But just had that mentality through the climb. Although the money was obviously important, it went on to help lots of people. And MRF did some massive bits in Malawi, getting some vaccinations and stuff out there, because it's still rife out there, unfortunately. You know, lots of people get it. We did some amazing stuff. But in terms of meningitis awareness, that blew up. So that was really good, because it went a bit viral, to be honest with you, and lots of people heard about it, which was probably the biggest thing we could have done anyway. It was a bit where there was... Because when you get up above a certain altitude, there's no foliage, there's no plants or anything, because they don't grow up there. So there was this huge track. It must have been 200 meters wide. And it went on for about, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile. And I was just carving down in my wheelchair, like left and right, like a snowboarder, but in a chair. That was really cool. The rest of it was so rocky and stuff. It was actually quite difficult to get down. You couldn't really ride it down in the chair. There wasn't any, you know, no paths or anything.
I just think that's incredible. What I love is I love the attitude that goes with it. You've just got, maybe that's part of that resilience. It's almost like this, oh, yeah, here we go. You know?
All right.
It's such a relaxed way of living, but obviously, you know, no one climbs Kilimanjaro to relax, but, you know, that whole kind of, yeah, okay, I'll give it a shot, you know. It's just a freer way to live.
If Gary Barlow can do it, anyone can do it.
Yeah, Chris Moyles. Can Chris Moyles make it to the top?
He did. Is there ever when you're asked to do something, Aaron, is there ever an element? Because I have this sometimes quite cavalier, some might say childish attitude, where if I get asked to do something that's a bit risky, I go, I'm already pretty disabled, what's the worst that's going to happen here? And then you crack on with it.
Yeah, that's a weird, I think so. I think you just... I think disability gives you perspective, doesn't it? Just being serious for a moment, I think it gives you a perspective on life and things, and you're like, kind of, what's the worst that can happen? Other people seem to just live inside this beautiful comfort zone, watch a bit of Netflix, go on Facebook, do bugger all their lives. That's up to them. They can do that if they want, but I'm not up for that. And I don't think any of you guys are either.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there was a time when I became disabled myself, it was like, I could sit there for the rest of my life, like you said, doing absolutely nothing, but I can't do that. You know, after playing, you know, Call of Duty for about a year, you just go, I can't do this forever. You know, yeah, you learn how to play 10 different, 20 different card games because you can't really do anything else at that time. And you just think, well, this is really boring. I want to do something. And it's just you can either sit there and do nothing and watch TV and watch Netflix all day, like you said, or you can actually do something with your life and try and make it a positive rather than just sitting back and letting it consume you, because if you do that, it's only going to take a short time before you got depression, you deteriorate, and so on and so forth. And the amount of people I've seen over the years where they do become disabled and they deteriorate rapidly is horrific.
What I think is, if you are happy to kind of embrace it and move with it, I think it gives you a bit of an aura and makes you a little bit different. You know, I think it's lots of people are exactly the same, aren't you? If you're disabled, there's something, you know, there's something that people are interested in you about. And I think if you can look at that as a positive, I'm a massive believer in kind of every cloud's got a silver lining kind of approach. You know, you, like you say, you can sit there and be negative about it, or you can try and make the best of what is a bad situation, but then probably turn it into more of a positive situation. But I think it kind of gives you a bit of an aura, doesn't it? It makes you a bit different. It makes people interested to find out about you. Like, you know, I think I'd meet someone with one arm. I go, oh, God, why have you got one arm? You know, it's just curiosity. But then, you know, you spark a conversation with someone, maybe make a new friend, you know?
I think also there's something happens, I think, with a lot of people when you get disability or crisis in some form thrust into your life. So I'm adjacent in that my family are affected by disability. But I went through a similar thing. You either take it on board and you work with it, but there's also something that happens that says, well, I'm going to give something back. So like you did Kilimanjaro, you also raised awareness and money for the charity that, you know, was involved with it as well. There's something that seems to happen innately that people, you become a more giving person and a more, I don't know, aware of others. You could become very insular very easily, but the opposite seems to happen.
That's an interesting point. You know what? I hadn't thought of it like that, but you're right. I did Kilimanjaro because it seemed like a cool challenge, but actually, yeah. We did do that massive awareness piece. And I think that comes with it, don't you? quite often I'm you know, trying to help other people who have become disabled, or quite often parents of disabled kids are contacting me asking for bits of advice, and just kind of point them in the right direction, help them where you can, can't you? Because once upon a time, you were that 15-year-old who was a little bit lost and needed a bit of support. And I guess that was, you know, links into the point I was making earlier about trying to find a support network. You know, we had that. We're an elite wheelchair rugby team. You know, some of my teammates were quite isolated during COVID. We were speaking to them and trying to big them up and keep them moving on, you know, and that's, we're like at the top of our game, if you can imagine, you know, and we need that support. Everyone needs that little bit of support.
Yeah.
Aaron, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you again. If people want to learn more about you, how can I do that? Where can people get hold of you?
AaronPhipps.com, or it's AaronPhipps GBWR on most socials. I'd really appreciate a follow, actually. Some of my teammates got more followers than me, and I like to beat them, to be honest.
So that is it from this section of the old Grumpy Git Show. And now it's time to cut back to us in the future. Woo! Time lapse finger movements. Woo! So, gentlemen, this Friday the 3rd of December is the International Day of Disabled People. And I don't know how I feel about days of this, weeks of that, months of that, and what have you. Because on one hand, it's raising awareness, it's a conversation, all awareness is good awareness, rock and roll. Economically for me, bloody great. I've got like 3 talks lined up end on end. I'll make about $5,000 that day. Though it does make us look a bit like Santa Claus, doesn't it? Here's the one day when you can say your stuff and then get back in the workshop and make me toys. So how do we all feel about it? Are days like this important, or does it need to be more of an ongoing thing? And where do you think the tipping point is between those two things?
What do you get from it? What's the end product? I mean, we say we're raising awareness. What have people done with the awareness? It's like the autism week that happens, or rare disease day, but what did the public do with the awareness?
This is another one of my issues. You find yourself mainly preaching to the choir when you do talks on days like International Day of Disabled People. And people get these like warm and fuzzies and go, oh my word, this day was so inspiring. And then that leads me back to your point, Chris. What have we inspired you to do? If you're just warm and fuzzy and glad you're not disabled, that's not being inspired. That's being a wanker. Whereas if you want to go out and like change the world, and you realise that there is systemic ableism in society, and you want to help fix it, that's being inspired.
No,
and
just do it. Do it. Just, you don't need a day or a week or a month. Just do it. Okay. Just, you don't need that amount of time to be different. Just don't be ableist. It's quite simple. It's not rocket science either. And that goes for anything. That goes for all the isms. You don't need to be that way. I don't understand why there needs to be a day, week, or month of anything, really.
I think the other problem that comes along with this is that every day is something.
Hmm.
And I think it's now just
crowded.
It's the frog in a pot syndrome for me. You know, what's the best way to cook a frog? If you just stuck it in hot water, it's going to jump out. You slowly heat the water. You just got used to it. And every day, oh, it's this day today, it's that day. And it all become very, it's all give us money. And people become really desensitized to it because it just becomes this sort of crassness to it associated. It's all about raising money for charities and stuff like that. And people are sick of that. And it doesn't, I feel it goes against what we're trying to achieve, which is an awareness and understanding and appreciation for what it's like day to day for disabled people, and how we can make that life better. How we can meet people where they're at.
It's a bit like walking through the high street, isn't it? When you get those people with the clipboard.
Yes.
And it might be an amazing cause, but because you've had day after day after day of different charities, no matter how much of a good cause it is, you kind of pretending to be on your phone, so you don't have to engage with it anymore.
A few years ago, when I was at uni, some of my mates decided they were going to introduce a drinking day for every day that ends in a Y.
Are they okay?
The penny will drop in a minute. So,
every day. Okay.
every God, day
that isn't genuine. Y,
they, but seriously, they did it so they could drink every single day. And for me, every day is International Disability Day. You know, I'm disabled every single day. It doesn't happen one day a year. And having it one day a year is the most ridiculous thing in the world. But on the other side, like Adam says, it gives in an income. I mean, having an International Disability Day does raise awareness. It does have an impact on the community and people do take it seriously. And it also may open up the ideas to businesses that actually we might need to pay attention to it once a year. And if they're doing it once a year, then they might implement it full time eventually. But it still has a long way to go to have an impact. And it shouldn't be an International Disability Day. It should be the law.
Absolutely. No, exactly. Literally human rights. Yeah. Human rights. Yes. Just because you're in a wheelchair. And again, there's people on Twitter about London and going out and even in Manchester where they can't even get down the street because they've got chairs, tables, doorways or steps. And you're treated as subhuman. That's disgusting. Yeah. So I do like the fact that it does raise awareness because it hurts them where it matters most for businesses, which is their back pocket. So if they're embarrassed and it does come out in the public, they have to change. They don't do it on a moral basis. They do it because it's going to affect their bank balance.
I'm being very cynical here. Is it just an excuse to compact it into one day and that's my thing for the year done and move on? I don't have to think about it for the other 364.2 days of the year.
Yeah, that's where what Simon says is really important. As people who are disabled or disability adjacent, we do make it a full-time thing and don't let people sort of do their little bit of virtue signalling on Friday the 3rd and then just go back to being half-assed about it for the rest of the year. And that's why I really like disabled and disability Twitter, because when things do go wrong, they're like straight on it, whether it's Lucy Edwards, like, just calling out Yo Sushi for not letting her guide dog in. But Mick Scarlett's always ranting on about how inaccessible Camden is. And we need, sort of, like, battle-tested, like, slightly angry voices like that to be that change. And moving into to Lad now, this might be my favourite reoccurring segment on our show, because whenever I introduce it, I'm always excited, but also slightly nervous. Not for both our editorial and for Chris's search history. Chris, what's our ridiculous story of the week?
This week, police admit officer did mistake paddling pool of goldfish for sharks. Just when you think you've heard it all, team attended a premises over the weekend only to discover an 8-foot swimming pool in a front room. In the pool were small sharks. Turned out it was a small paddling pool with a pump and filter with goldfish.
Oh, please tell me you got a photo of this.
Yeah, we've got the article. We'll stick it on. But I don't know whether that's an over-exaggerating copper or... there's a news article for it and the police exaggerated it. I don't know how
Do you think they got caught with the had a paddling pool of goldfish in their living room? Because what I'm thinking is what were they preparing for the fair down the road at the end of the week?
was it just like a home run foot spa thing?
I think it was a child's paddling pool. It was a child's paddling pool.
I don't need this crazy expensive spa days. Come over here, mate. I'll
paddle with goldfish. But I don't know how you get goldfish confused with sharks.
If it was
catfish,
they are a shark.
They are. Can you imagine if Steven Spielberg had made that mistake when he directed Jaws?
Can you imagine the size of that goldfish?
Lips.
and getting guns and trying to shoot the goldfish over the side.
I'm going straight to Austin Powers with goldfish with lasers on their heads.
We're going to need a smaller boat.
I can't believe that came out of Simon's mouth.
That is the funniest thing you've ever said.
It's taken him 9 episodes, but he's finally said something funny.
Yes. Oh.
Oh, episode done. I don't think we're going to beat that. No, I don't think any of us are going to top that. So let's just bring this on home. So from all of us at Grumpy Gets, take care, get hold of us. Any thoughts, feedback, questions, requests, we'll happily do. And we'll see you all on the next one. Take care.